Well, Daryl Scott joins the show now. Welcome, Daryl.
Hey, Luke.
How are you, sir?
Doing good. It's night time where I am right now.
Uh-huh.
And it gets dark early now that we have whatever the daylight savings or whatever this is called. But it feels like winter is just around the corner. I know it's that way in Colorado.
Well, it's weird, though. It feels like, you know, it's one of those long, long, long Indian summers that feels like it's a cherry on top, you know?
Wow. Well, good for you. Good for you guys.
Well, in a way, it's kind of nice, but you know what? We need snow. We need lots of snow, and it just ain't happening yet.
Well, may it happen.
Well, when I spoke to you 10 years ago on the release of A Crooked Road, you told me a story about you and your love for Colorado and how it came about. Maybe you could reprise that a little bit for our listeners. Apparently, you spent some time on the top of your dad's RV in Colorado. Tell me about that.
Yes, I did. We had this RV. It was a Travco. It was one of those fiberglass things that rounded, and it's an odd story in that we had a booking, and this is when I was a teenager, and we had a booking in Grand Junction, and I was kind of a smart aleck kid. I guess I'm still smart alecky at times, but on the way there, and it was a family band, me and my brothers and my dad, and it was a honky-tonk. It was just a bar in Grand Junction in 1976 or so. And on the way up, I was teasing like, hey, you know what? This is going to be across the street from the bus depot. You know, it's going to be a really kind of dangerous, dark feeling bar. And, you know, I was just kind of, and turned out when we got up, drove up to the place, and this is coming from Southern California, it was everything that I said. And, so my dad walked into the bar and kind of checked it out, and he basically said, you know, me and my family aren't going to play here. So we left the bar we were supposed to play at for like a week-long engagement or whatever it was back in the day. And so we drove then through Colorado. I guess we'd gone up through Utah. We came back through Colorado to get back to California. And that's what you're referring to. So there was one night we stayed somewhere in the Rockies, somewhere at a giant vista, somewhere at a pull off of the road, and my dad and I and a brother got on top of the Travco and saw just the most spectacular night sky I've ever seen in my life. And that was my first, if Grand Junction was my first rub with Colorado, which was again funny, and you know, we just didn't, you know, play the dive bar. But then the real Colorado showed up that night on top of that motorhome, and just like a sky that I just, you know, like, you know, you how you get out there, especially 1976, and so I've just had this ongoing love for Colorado, the Rockies, the mountains, those streams, ever since. And then, you know, flash, you know, forward probably 20 years from that, the first time I really played Colorado was with, and it was Telluride Festival, with Sam Bush. So Sam, I played in Sam's band for 2 years, two seasons, and my first playing in Colorado started at Telluride Festival with, you know, Sam being the king of Telluride, and that was my first glimpse of, you know, festival life and Ooh. And Telluride life mm-hmm. and this great festival and the Colorado people who love music and are natural folks, natural people and good people and all that good stuff. So Sam was my first, you know, the guy who showed me, you know, the Telluride that he had come to know. And of course, I've been back so many, many, many times since to, you know, the Boulder, you know, the Western Slopes, over on the Denver side of things, and, you know, the Four Corners and all that. So I just love Colorado. And it started back at that night on top of a Travco motorhome when I was, I don't know, 16 or something, 15. I was probably 16. And then, again, part two started then with Sam Bush and at Telluride Festival. So, yeah, I've had a love affair for Colorado for a long, long time, and I still got it.
And I ask about that, Daryl, because your most recent CD called Jaroso was recorded in Colorado in an old church. Maybe you could describe for our listeners the church.
The church is an adobe church that used to be a Catholic, Spanish-speaking church in Jaroso. And a friend of mine bought it after it had closed or had gone somewhere else or wherever churches go when they aren't in their old locations. And he bought it, and it had goats, you know, were in it from, you know, bats were in it. And it was just a, you know, an abandoned, decrepit space. But the outside looked, you know, kind of like it always did. It's basically a maybe 30 feet by 40 feet as an interior, and just a sweet, you know, white adobe church that a friend of mine, Mark Dudrow, who's a musician and a potter, had invited me, you know, for years, telling me about his place. And he doesn't live in the church. He always wanted the church thing, to, that space, to be a place for shows and concerts or music, creative stuff. And, you know, he lived maybe a block or so away from it. And he'd asked me for years, and just the schedule never kind of worked out, because a lot of times we're just kind of running the roads. And but this one particular year, after I'd played Four Corners festival, you know, over a Labor Day weekend at Pagosa, it worked out to where I could come out after Pagosa and go down to Jaroso and see his place. But instead of just seeing it, I kind of already had an idea what it would be like. I basically cast an album recording, and then with about a week's notice, just word of mouth to folks, you know, in Santa Fe and Taos, and just said, hey, come on out to a recording that I'm going to do. And so there was no PA, and just sitting in front of, you know, the 40 or 50 people. And I just saw it as an opportunity to make a really sweet recording that just didn't sound like it was a big deal or trying to be a big deal. As a matter of fact, trying to make it sound just as simple as, you know, playing songs without a PA in front of people. And so that became what we wanted to do with this Jaroso recording. And I think we did exactly what we set out to do. It's a very simple, humble, sweet recording in a former adobe church, an active church from yesteryear.
You had that crowd singing along on some of those tunes, and I have to say it might be the most in-tune crowd singing I've ever heard. So congratulations that.
Yeah, they were more in tune than I was, actually. Well, it was, you know, there was just that sweetness in the air about it, because it wasn't a regular sort of promoted show. It was no PA. It wasn't a, you know, tickets or ta-da or all that kind of stuff. It was just almost a pop-up, really. That'd be the best way to put it. It was a pop-up that had a recording component to it. And that recording component was really simple. A mic on my voice, a mic on my instrument, and then a stereo miking out in the audience. Because I did anticipate people singing, and I chose songs that people would and could sing along to. And, you know, there's two Colorado songs on the record.
Yes, I wanted
one to that ask. I wrote and one that Merle Haggard recorded. And I did both of those in on this recording. And so I kind of went into this knowing it would be and hoping it would be just sweet and unencumbered and just natural and, you know, chairs. You can hear chairs moving. You can hear people coughing. You can hear me singing out of tune, or I mess up some guitar stuff and all that. And it was no big deal. Because it isn't. It's just not a big deal. And I wanted the recording to kind of stand for that. And, yeah, people sang along. And we just had a nice, sweet time, and the recording really captures that, I think, you know, right on.
Mission accomplished.
Perfect.
No doubt about
it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
That's exactly how we felt.
Which Colorado song did you write, Daryl? The Have You Ever Been Down to Colorado, or the other one?
The other one, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the one called Colorado. They're, oddly enough, they're both called Colorado. And so when I put the liner notes, I added, have you ever been down to, and then Colorado as the one song. Uh-huh. And then I might have even said something like, Colorado, I need healing, or something, maybe for the second one. But it's the one that ends the show, or the recording, uh-huh, that is the one I wrote. And I wrote that in Colorado. A few years ago, Colorado runs real deep for me, like I said, since I was about 16, and I just have returned. You know, honestly, Colorado audiences of music are just the best in the country.
Huh.
They just know music, and they love, part of it is things like Telluride's been going on all this time. Part of it is stations like yours, where people, you know, hear more authentic music than just what's kind of being piped out of giant stations in the big cities. You know, there's intimate music, there's intimate radio stations, there's intimate bands, there's intimate festivals, there's intimate bars where music is being played. And, Colorado has been just a hotbed of music for a long time. That's why there is a Telluride festival, you know, and that's why there's an E-Town, you know, and on and on and on. And I saw that immediately with Sam. You know, that's where I really saw it and was introduced to, you know, this amazing thing of Colorado people, Colorado landscape, and music. It goes together really, really well.
Yes, it does. No doubt about it. You know, I'm sure you're aware of a show like yours in a place like that, which doesn't see a lot of shows probably very often. It must have been, the folks must have been on, I don't know what, Seventh Heaven or Cloud Nine or somewhere.
You know, I think they were, and I was too. I mean, it really felt as if we all knew something really unique was going to happen that night. And all it was a simple, you know, 30 by 40 space with a guy, you know, I'd borrowed some instruments. There was a banjo that someone brought. Someone brought a 12 string. Someone brought a gut string that I played. And I had my guitar. And it was that kind of casualness to it. Mm. And, yeah, I think the folks felt it was a special event, and I know that I did, which was why, I wanted to record it. I had a feeling about it. And we only had about a week to do it. Mm. It was only a week before that we said, yeah, let's do this, and let's try to get some people up from, you know, Taos or Santa Fe or, you know, in the southern Colorado area. Let's word of mouth and just have a pop-up. And we're going to record this thing. So it was that kind of loose. And I think the recording exactly captures that kind of loose kind of thing. And that's sort of what we set out to do.
It sounded like a bunch of people singing in church, which is exactly what it was.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was so on target that we pulled that off.
Yes, you did. No doubt about it. You know, what you did at the end with Colorado and how let's see, you were all singing together, and then it faded out with some applause, and then there were some crickets, and then you faded back up the music. Really nice little touch. I really like that.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, I'm a sucker for field recording. I love field recording. You know, like the Alan Lomax stuff, or Lead Belly, or recordings, and even old 78s. I've got hundreds of 78 records in my back room, and I've got I have a station that just plays. A turntable basically that just plays 78, and you can hear it in the recordings that those people sat in front of a single mic on a 78 and played what you're hearing. And there's not all that sort of hoopla and fixing it in the mix or any of the things the modern technology has brought us in recording. And, you know, when you're hearing a Carter Family on a 78, it's them sitting in front of a microphone and singing, or Duke Ellington, or Grappelli, or Roy Acuff, and on and on and on. And field recordings of great old folk music and blues and all that. So I'm a sucker for those kind of authentic recordings, and that was another driving force for our recording of Horoso. It was just live. There's something about live music, and you know somebody is singing that thing live. The audience is listening, and there's just something about live music, which ironically during this pandemic and lockdown styles of things that we've all had to do, man, one of the biggest things we're missing is gathering together, mm-hmm. hearing music or festivals and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
that came into play too, even though Horoso was my second album of this year of 2020, I just thought we need, you know, let's remember what live music is and does for us, and that's what Horoso was as a recording. That's what I wanted.
You recorded that last year?
No, in terms of actually recording it, it was probably about 3 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had this in the can for a while,
uh-huh.
as they say. That's the big business word for it. But I had this recorded, and I have other things recorded too, by the way. I'm just, that's the way I do things. So when I get the idea of like a recording, you know, I'll almost stop everything I'm doing otherwise and hone in on the recording. The releasing of it is a whole nother deal. Mm. I'm still trying to figure out releasing records, but as far as recording records, I love recording, you know, and again, it can be like the Horoso record or a finely tuned, you know, studio album or whatever. I like the idea of recording. I think it's a magic medium.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, this isn't the first release this year from you. The first one this year was Daryl Scott Sings the Blues of Hank Williams.
So, yeah.
And what a wonderful album. I really want to dive into that one. But so you had that one in the can too, I guess, before everybody locked
Absolutely.
Down.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, we had it scheduled to come out in April. And when the pandemic happened, you know, we really asked ourselves, I mean, me and, you know, my wife, my agent, my assistant, you know, the people who were going to put it out and distribute it, we really asked, like, are we going to put this out when we can't even go tour? And normally that's how it all gets done. You know, we tour and folks come to shows and they, you know, they hear about it or whatever it gets written about or whatever. And we had to answer that right away. It was like, yeah, we're still going to release this, even though we don't even have shows to go do this at. I had 85 shows for this year, and all but probably five or less stayed, you know. But that was the first thing we did during lockdown was like, are we going to continue and put this record out of Hank, the Hank, you know, record in April, And, you know, we all know the timeline. You know, March was when it all started happening, and April was already slotted months in advance to release that Hank record. And the answer was, yeah, we're still going to do this, and we'll just figure this thing out because we're all in lockdown or something like that. And I decided, you know, the music's still going to come out, including the Horoso, the record, coming out, you know, in October. So that's just what you do. That's what I did in a pandemic,
mm-hmm.
you know, is to keep the music flowing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Hank Williams has been part of your life since you were a kid, hasn't he?
Yeah, that same dad I was talking about earlier loved Hank Williams.
Huh.
And so that's where I learned, you know, my love and respect and knowledge of Hank Williams' catalog was through my dad. And so I knew, you know, all the Hank Williams songs, you know, not just the hits, but I knew them because my dad was a Hank Williams fanatic. And so when it came time to do that record, you know, I knew the songs, and I just wanted to pick songs that weren't the most known songs of Hank's,
mm-hmm.
you know. Probably the most known thing on there is
Lonesome Whistle.
Yeah, Lonesome Whistle. People know that one. And then there's, oh, God, I don't know how I'm blanking. Lost Highway.
Yeah.
Most people know that as a Hank. But Hank didn't write Lost Highway.
Oh, really?
A guy named Leon Payne.
Huh.
But it's very, of course, we all associate it with Hank Williams.
Yeah.
And so the songs I chose were a little off the beaten path, but would also hold on to the idea I had, which was to kind of blues up, you know, with B3 organ, Reese Winans, great, amazing player, and then get me on the electric guitar for a lot of it. And that became basically the idea behind the Hank record, was to kind of do my electric blues version of some of the Hank stuff.
You know, the challenge for an artist doing a covers album is to make the songs your own. And I think you succeeded really strongly on a couple points. One is, you just mentioned the B3. Was that your idea, to bring the B3 into the mix?
Absolutely, yeah. Uh-huh. And not only the B3, it was literally the B3 player, Reese Winans.
Yeah.
And Reese, for those who don't know, I mean, is just, he played in the Stevie Ray Vaughan was a power trio, Stevie Ray and bass and drums. And Stevie Ray did what Stevie Ray did and became known for as that power trio. And then kind of late in his career, he added a fourth piece, and it was Reese Winans on keyboard, B3 and piano. So Reese comes to, you know, that record from my knowledge, you know, and love of Stevie Ray Vaughan. And I know how good Reese Winans is because of my Stevie Ray records and shows that I've seen of Stevie Ray Vaughan back in the day. And so you know, it wasn't just B3 as a sound. It was Reese Winans playing B3 that became very, I had to have him, because he's just a monster player.
Yeah, and it really made those indelible songs yours, I think, on the album. That's one of the things that did. The other thing that did that made that the way you made these songs your own, your singing on this album is a revelation to me. I mean, I always knew you were a pretty good singer, but my God, there's moments on this album, Daryl, where it just soars. It's unfettered. It's full throated. It's completely assured. It's just, and you can, you soar, and then you can turn it on a dime and express something very, very delicate. It's just
wow. Thank you, Luke. That's high praise, man.
Well, it's,
thank you.
It was a pleasure, and you know, I've listened to the album at least 10 times now, and I can't say that about most new releases these days, even from old lions such as yourself. You know, there's just something about this one that just really gets me. I want to talk for a minute about the one, the Spoken Blues. What was it called? The Men with Broken Hearts. There's a good example of nuance in your singing, although you weren't really singing. You were just sort of talking. Were you talking over the music, or were you reading that alone with no musical accompaniment?
Well, how I started that recording was, you're not going to believe this one, but next time you listen, think of this. I started on piano just by myself, like no voice, anything, and I played alternate chords to the national anthem, believe it or not. So next time you listen to that, you know, think of ba-da-da-da-da. I mean, it's there. I did it absolutely on purpose.
Oh, wow.
And so how I started that song was to sit at the piano playing alternate chords, you know, not regular old, you know, brass, you know, national anthem thing, but kind of like take the national anthem and retool it, redo it in a, and, you know, as a bass, as the music behind it, as the chords, and then put this Hank Williams text over top of it, speaking really about compassion for, you know, he calls it men with broken hearts, but it's people who, you know, are down on their luck, street people, people who don't have a home, people who've lost everything. And that's the Hank Williams text. And I just thought the juxtaposition of Hank talking about that subject needed to sit in the bed of the national anthem. And it's not a real obvious thing. There's only a couple times we let it out melodically, but it's there. And that became something just really important for me to want to do, was to put that message of Hank Williams, probably late 40s, early 50s, that he wrote it. And we still have the same things going on today, mm-hmm. about, you know, when you see someone, you know, who's, you know, had a hard time, they don't have a home, you know, you can't hardly, we have trouble looking people in the eye and that kind of thing. And Hank wrote this amazing text that was never sung. It was always spoken. So when Hank did it, it was spoken. Johnny Cash recorded it. It was spoken. And to me, that was a standout that I knew I had to have on this record, because I just loved that, what he was saying. And I just, what got in under my skin was to make it an American statement by subtly putting in the national anthem very quietly, hardly can find it, but it's there, I promise, because I thought those two belonged together, the national anthem and Hank Williams' Men with Broken Hearts.
You know, it's some of the most tender, compassionate reading that I've heard in a long, long time. The quality of the quality of your voice just slays me, and it just so perfectly captures, you know, what was it you said towards the end? Sometimes life can be so cruel that a heart wants to die, or something like that. Oh,
yeah, the heart will pray for death.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, that's Hank Williams. That's not me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Hank Williams, and that's just me speaking what Hank spoke in 1951 or something, or 1949 or whatever it was. And yeah, that's Hank Williams right there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I grew up on. I grew up on that side of Hank Williams. It wasn't all, hey, good looking and jambalaya and, you know, kinds of, you know, real perky, great Hank Williams country songs, no doubt. I grew up on the dark side, the dark stuff, you know, the Luke the Drifter stuff. And Hank made a record called Luke the Drifter, and MGM, his label, wouldn't even let him put it out under Hank Williams because they it was such a strong statement, and it was him speaking a lot, recitations in the record. And they said, well, we're not going to put this out as a Hank Williams record. And he came up with Luke the Drifter. Mm-hmm. And that song, that Men with Broken Hearts, comes from that record. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the finest moments of Hank Williams, period, is Luke the Drifter.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk for a minute about the When You're Tired of Breaking Others' Hearts. That's you on the steel guitar, isn't it?
Yeah. 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 That one was, you know, there's one. Most people don't know that song. It's just a very B or C side, you know, of Hank Williams. He might have only done a demo of it, as a matter of fact. The you know, just him and a guitar, just turning in publishing demos or something. But that's a song that my dad would sing around the house. And so when I did this Hank record, I just knew I wanted to do that song. And I always thought, you know, Hank had one of the greatest steel players of all time. And I wanted to record it, just a vocal and steel. And so I did. And so the original recording of that is me on steel and singing at the same time. And then when I finished it, I thought, man, Reese Winans is going to tear this up. So I threw Reese on it. And then that's what we got is the end result, is me and Reese on it. Hmm. But yeah, that's me on the lap steel, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun. That was a fun one to do.
Well, that song also really points up the strength of your singing. Some of those high notes that you hit, and then going right back down the scale, just really, really impressive singing.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you.
Well, what's next for Daryl Scott? I guess you're just sort of hunkering. You have a farm now, and I guess you're sort of building a new homestead for yourself. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. And really what I've done just since pandemic, because of the lockdown, it means I'm home.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause normally I'm out doing shows and stuff, and you know, and then you get home and then you're just kind of recuperating and doing laundry or getting ready for the next time out. But since I've been off, really since late February, roughly speaking, it meant that I could start a studio out here.
Nice.
So we've been working on a studio out here, and it's going to be really cool. And we've got the floors, we've got the walls, we've got the windows, the doors, we got heating, we got insulation. And so we're very close to being done, even on the studio. So, you know, I just took this time at pandemic. You know, yes, there were the two albums that came out as part of the deal, but also another part of the deal was working on a studio space, a really good size studio space as well. And that has been, it's almost complete. And that began in about April of this year. And the timing has worked out where we could do it. We could get good carpenters and good electricians at the right time. And it just seemed like things just fell into place to kind of make that happen during this time where, you know, I'm not doing what I normally do, which is out doing shows and all that. And that's just been another one of those things that I was able to do because I can't go out and tour. So I'll bet you in the next 3 months or less, I will have an absolute active studio, and my instruments, I'll get all my instruments out here, my piano, guitars, and all that stuff. And I'll bet you, you know, in a very short amount of time, all that will be available, you know, for recording out there.
How about that? Now, have you been
Have
you been writing too during this time?
No, not a whole bunch. Mm-hmm. A little bit. Mostly what I've been doing is working on records like the Hank, you know, like the Heroso, another one I started about 3 weeks ago, and then others recordings that I have already well underway. So this time at home of not touring is allowing me to get those records out, which is, it's one thing to make the records or write the songs and the this and that, but it's a whole other thing to actually release them. And I found a way to do it because I'm not touring, because I can't tour. And so I'm working on music.
That sounds good. I can't wait till we see another one. We were so lucky to have two from you this year, and looking forward to the next one.
And yeah, there's definitely more coming. No doubt about it.
Well, good. And then I guess that means at some point when things get normal again, we'll see you out in Colorado again. Yay.
Absolutely. Yay. I can't wait. I can't wait. I hope next year we get to all gather again like we all love to do in festivals or at shows or listening rooms or performing arts centers or whatever it is, you know. We've been missing that link for sure.
And we deserve it, don't we?
Absolutely.
Yes, no doubt about it. Darryl Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for your time. And keep doing what you're doing, too. So since we don't have shows, we got to have the good radio and the good music that's popping through. So you guys got to keep this up. You just have to.
Will do.
Okay, man.
Okay, take care, Darryl.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.